The time is 1:36 p.m. Let's call this meeting of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order. We are in Belt's Room 105, the Thomas Stewart Building in the beautiful capital city of Juneau. Snow is falling. It just looks lovely outside. Members present in today's committee are Senator Merrick, Senator Gray Jackson, Senator Dunbar, and myself, Senator Bjorkman. Senator Bishop will be along momentarily. Today is Wednesday, March 15th, 2023. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please turn off and silence your cell phones. I'd like to recognize and welcome our recording secretary, Juliana Singh, and our LIO moderator, Jake Wade. Today we have one item on our agenda, Senate Bill 88, Retirement Systems and Defined Benefit Option. We heard this bill on Monday of this week when we had a presentation of the bill and went through the first half of the sectional analysis. Today, it is my intention to complete the sectional, review a summary table, and take invited testimony. Senator Kathy Giesel, her staff, Julia O'Connor, and Sonia Kawasaki, legal counsel to the Senate majority, are here to start us off today. Welcome, everyone, to Senate Labor and Commerce.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Kathy Giesel. I am the state senator for Senate District E, as in Echo, that's located in Anchorage. Mr. Chairman, as we begin, I wanted to make a couple clarifying points related to subjects we discussed on Monday. The first one is somewhat trivial, I guess, but you had a section in your binder that included a PowerPoint and it was labeled House Bill 55. That was inaccurate. I understand that my staff went around and corrected that tab. This is actually, it's prefaced by a four-page letter and then followed by multiple-page PowerPoint. It was prepared by pension trustee advisors it was prepared on January 18th, 2021. This PowerPoint was never presented. In other words, the documents were prepared. It was prepared for the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, but never presented by Mr. William Fornia, who is the president of that Pension Trustee Advisors. The PowerPoint goes through an actuarial assessment of the elements that were incorporated into Senate Bill 88. So it's essentially an actuarial assessment done on Senate Bill 88. The elements of 88. So I just wanted to clarify that so that if you're looking at it, it's absolutely true. It parallels the current bill very, very closely. The second clarifying statement I wanted to make relates to the slide on slide 18 of the PowerPoint. This is where I presented a slide that was presented in Senate Finance last week by the Division of Retirement and Benefits. And it showed what the funding would look like if the pension fund and the healthcare fund were combined. In the last 2 days, there have been multiple conversations about whether that combining of those two funds could actually occur. There'll be more information forthcoming as we clarify that through tax attorneys and others. So I just wanted to bring that to your attention. There'll be more information coming. So those were my only clarifying statements. Mr. Chairman, thank you for the time and allowance to make those.
Absolutely. Thank you, Senator Giesel. Julia, we left off last time with you going through the sectional. If you could please resume your presentation of the sectional and just let us know for the record who you are and where you are beginning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Julia O'Connor, staff to Senator Giesel. I left off on Section 54, and we'll be moving on to Section 55. Section 55 is conforming language. Section 56 is conforming language. Section 57 modifies current law to ensure that the state may not amend the health reimbursement arrangement coverage in a way that would violate Article 12, Section 7 of the Alaska Constitution, which prevents diminishment or impairment of accrued retirement benefits and federal law. Section 58 modifies current law to ensure that the state may not retroactively reduce accrued benefits of the health reimbursement arrangement coverage except as permitted by the Article 12, Section 7 of the Alaska Constitution and federal law. Section 59 modifies current law to ensure that while the state may terminate the health reimbursement arrangement coverage, it may not do so in a way that would violate Article 12, Section 7 of the Alaska Constitution and federal law. Section 60 rephrases current law to assign the plan administrator the directive to return a mistaken employer contribution under the TERS and PERS DC tiers. The new TERS Teacher Retirement System DB Defined Benefit Plan and the new PERS Public Employee Retirement System Defined Benefit Plan Health Reimbursement Arrangement Plan to the employer within a year of its discovery. Section 61 is conforming language. Section 62 establishes applicability of the state's PERS DB plans to employees who are not members of the PERS DC plan, including those who elected out of the PERS DC plan into the new PERS DB plan by November 1, 2024, as well as new employees. Section 63 creates exceptions to the contribution rates of 7.5% for police and firefighters and 6.75% for other employees for the new PERS DB plan under later subsections E and F, and deletes the employer's required process for obtaining the employee's contribution through payroll deduction, which is reestablished under later subsection G. Section 64 adds new subsections E for police and firefighters and subsection F for other state employees, establishing the employee contribution rate under the new PERS DB plan at 8% of the employee's base salary for the first year. Thereafter, the plan may be variable 8 to 10% as adjusted by the ARM Board, Alaska Retirement Management Board. Also establishes new subsection G, providing the employer's required process for obtaining employees' contribution through payroll deduction. Section 65 establishes a qualifier to the PERS DB employer contribution rate of 22% of the total of all base salaries paid by the employer under later subsection J. Section 66 references an additional stipulated employee contribution rate mandated by law for the new PERS DB plan under later subsection J. Section 67 provides that when a retired member is rehired, the employer shall include the member's base salary in the employer's contribution calculation. Section 68 provides that the employer contribution rate of 22% of the total of all base salaries of the employees applies to the new PERS DB plan, except that the rate may decrease by the ARM Board, but only when the system is not experiencing a past service cost, and only to a minimum floor of 12% of the total monthly compensation of the new PERS DB plan members. If the ARM Board increases the percentage above 12%, it must coincide with the concurrent increase to the employee contribution rate. Section 69 requires that employer contributions for retiree major medical insurance and the health reimbursement arrangement plan must be accounted for separately and deposited into their respective trust accounts. Section 70 is conforming. Section 71 adds new subsections establishing the new PERS DB plan qualifications for the retirement benefits are age 60 with at least 5 years of credited service, age 55 for a peace officer or firefighter with at least 20 years of credited service, age 50 for a peace officer or firefighter with at least 25 years of credited service, or at least 30 years of credited service. Section 72 is conforming. Section 73 is conforming. Section 74 authorizes the ARM Board to decrease or eliminate the post-retirement pension adjustment, PERPA, if the past service costs of the new PERS DB plan attributable to the members of the new plan rises greater than 10%. Section 75 eliminates the 10% cost of living adjustment, or COLA, for the new PERS DB plan. Section 76 is conforming. Section 77 is conforming. Section 78 establishes the members of the new PERS DB plan is not eligible for major medical coverage provided under prior PERS DB tiers, but may elect medical benefits under AS 39-35-537, addressing the medical benefits of the new PERS DB plan. Section 79 establishes the medical benefit for the members of the new PERS DB plan that, if elected and applied for, provides access to retiree major medical insurance, which supplements Medicare at the age of 65 and provides access to the retiree monetary account under Health Reimbursement Arrangement Plan of AS 39-30-300. This section also establishes that a retiree may use the Health Reimbursement Arrangement Plan funds to pay the cost of premiums to continue medical insurance coverage. The cost of the premiums before 65 are the full monthly cost for group premiums. The cost of the premiums for retirees at the age of 65 who are eligible for Medicare is scaled depending on number of years of service. Section 80 is conforming. Section 81 is conforming. Section 82 is conforming. Section 83 ensures that an employer whose employees currently belong to the PERS DC plan is required to participate in the new PERS DB plan. Section 84 is conforming. Section 85 ensures that the employer contribution rate under AS 39-35-255J does not apply to contributions by employers to PERS DC plan member retirement accounts, retiree major medical coverage, and the Health Reimbursement Arrangement Plan, or as actuarially required to fully fund occupational disability and death benefits. Section 86 modifies current law to ensure that the state may not amend the PERS DC plan in a way that would violate the Alaska Constitution or federal law. Section 87 modifies current law to ensure that the state may not retroactively reduce accrued benefits of the PERS DC plan except as permitted by the Alaska Constitution and federal law. Section 88 modifies current law to ensure that while the state may terminate the PERS DC plan, it may not do so in a way that would violate the Alaska Constitution or federal law. Section 89 rephrases current law to assign the plan administrator the directive to return a mistaken employer contribution under the PERS DC plan to the employer within a year of its discovery. Section 90 repeals AS 1425012C regarding the effective dates of the prior TERS DB tiers, repeals AS 1425061 regarding retroactive indebtedness for prior TERS DB tiers, repeals AS 1425540 concerning transfer into the TERS DC tier by members of the previous TERS DB tier, and repeals AS 3935940 concerning transfer to the PERS DC tier by the member of the previous PERS DB tier. After the sectional members, there is a full repealer section with the entire statutes. Section 91 provides uncodified transitional law allowing members of the TERS and PERS DC tiers to transfer into the new TERS and PERS DB plans. Section 92 provides uncodified transitional law regarding the procedure for TERS and PERS DC members who elect to transfer into the new DB plan. Section 93 authorizes the Armed Board and the Commissioner of the Department of the Administration to adopt regulations necessary to implement the Act. Section 94 establishes the regulation authority has immediate effective date. Section 95 establishes the Act to take effect July 1, 2024. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. O'Connor. You did a great job. Next, Ms. Kawasaki, if you could put yourself on the record and go over the color-coded chart that we see on the screen in the room before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and the members of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, I'm Sonia Kawasaki, legal counsel to the Alaska Senate Majority Coalition. You will find in your binders a summary table of the policy decisions that were made for SB 88 and where they are effectuated in the bill. It has color blocks at the top of the with the categories covered on the chart, and it's dated March 3rd, 2023. This document has been useful as a tool to help people understand what's addressed in the bill. I'd like to go through this document with you all. First, however, I'd like to let the members know about the structure of the bill. The TERS and PERS sections of our state statutes are separated from each other. The bill is 50 pages, and changes in the TERS statutes appear first in the bill, which are sections 1 through 47 on pages 1 through 27. Changes in PERS statutes start on page 35, sections 62 through 69. And the bill also includes the changes we needed to make to the administration of both PERS and TERS, which appear in between the TERS and PERS statute changes in sections 48 and 49. These cover the Armed Board's duties toward the new plan. And there are changes also to medical coverage statutes that affect both TERS and PERS, and they're located in sections 50 to 61 on pages 30 to 35. So I will get started with the summary table. The green-coded column furthest to the left lists the benefit categories that were considered by stakeholders and the senator. Blue is the new proposed PERS DB plan for police and firefighters. Orange is regular PERS employees. The yellow column is TERS for teachers. The fourth column over, that's pink, covers the rationale for the policy choices. And then the far red column to the far right, you can see the benefit categories covered in the legislation. So the first benefit category is employee contribution rate. You've heard testimony before you already that the decision was made to allow the Armed Board to adjust the rate 8 to 10%. Depending on the past service cost, the rate will start at 8% for the first year, and then thereafter the board could adjust it, and all three categories of employees opted to apply that variable rate to all three categories of employees. The employees share the risks, and they contribute more during poor market returns. And
briefings. Back on the record.
Thank you, Mr.
Kawasaki. Please continue.
Thank you. For the record, again, Sonia Kawasaki, legal counsel to the Alaska Senate Majority Coalition. The second benefit category is the employer contribution. As we've heard, this will be the existing limit of 22% for the employer. In statute right now, the state actually doesn't have a maximum limit, so the state contributes above 22%, but the limit for the general employer is 22% for PERS and 12.56% for TERS. And as I said, those are existing limits, and then the bill will introduce a 12% floor once unfunded liability is paid off. And the 12% is seen by pension experts as the necessary minimum. And this is of the total, the salaries of all the members in the tier. Vesting is 5 years for all of the categories of employees. PERS is consistent with the prior PERS DB tiers, and we aligned TERS with PERS. And teachers previously vested at 8 years. Qualification for retirement, police and firefighters 50 years old with 25 years of service or 55 with 20 years of service. For regular public employees, 60 years of age or 30 years of service, and that will be the same for the TERS tier. The
Senator Bishop has a question.
Sure.
Ms. Kawasaki, under the vesting, is there an hour requirement that would make a constitute a year as well? Meaning that you, is there, I'm mixing Taft-Hartley here a little bit with public employees, and then the change about 10 years ago, I won't give you the full history lesson, but I think it was up to 250 hours in our business would constitute a year. So I'm thinking where my head is going is part-time employees that might be seasonal from a vesting standpoint.
Right,
where you might have EFF firefighters or something out there on the line, or part-time, you know, part-time summer hire employees for DOT, flaggers, Local 71 out on our asphalt repair jobs. You know, what constitutes a year, long and short of it? And if you can't answer me, that's fine. If you can get back to the answer.
Through the chair, I believe we have representatives from Division of Retirement and Benefit on the line who could respond to Senator Bishop.
Please do. If any of our folks from DRB online wanted to respond to the partial year of service, that would be great.
Through the chair, this is Mindy Voigt, Retirement Operations Manager for Public Employees Retirement System for part-time. In order to receive a year of credit, they must work 1,560 hours.
Thank you.
Ms. Kawasaki, please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record again, Sonia Kawasaki, legal counsel to the Senate majority. Second page, the benefit calculation formula. As proposed for the new PERS plan for public safety would be 2.0% for the first 10 years of service and 2.5% thereafter. For the new PERS non-public safety employees, 2.0 for the first 10 years, 2.25 for the next 10 years, and then 2.5% thereafter. And for the TERS employees, 2.0 for the first 10 years, 2.25 for the next 10 years, and 2.5% for the next for thereafter. This was for the PERS employees, public safety and non-public safety, this was consistent with prior PERS Tier 3, and we aligned TERS with the PERS benefit calculation, and otherwise teachers had previously received 2.0% for 20 years, and then thereafter 2.5%. So this is an incremental step for those next 10 years for the teachers.
Thank you. Senator Bishop, Senator Dunbar has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize, I didn't interrupt right after Senator Bishop's question, but I have a follow-on to that for the director who was just discussing it. So with that hours requirement for a good year, can you, let's say we have a seasonal employee, pretty common, and they get half the required number of hours in 1 year and half the next year. Can they stack that for one good year, or is it sort of an on or off switch based on how many hours you do in a year?
Ms. Voigt, that question was for you, if you heard that.
Mindy Voigt, through the chair, for a part-time employee, whatever hours they are they work in the calendar year, is their service is given based on the number of hours divided by 1560, and whatever they work is added on to. So however long it takes them to work, say they only work 0.5 in 1 year and then a 0.5 in the next year, each year adds up to be that 5 years for PERS.
Excellent. Thank you. That's what I was hoping. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Kawasaki.
Thank you. Sonia Kawasaki, legal counsel to the Alaska Senate majority. The next benefit category is the final average salary. This is the highest five consecutive years for all employee categories, and the PERS non-public safety is consistent with the last PERS DB tier, tier three. And then the PERS public safety and TERS will align with PERS non-public safety for this final average salary calculation. PERS public safety was previously based on the highest three consecutive payroll years, and teachers were previously based on highest three contract salaries. The next benefit category is the cost of living. Due to a concern for cost to employers, the bill would eliminate the cost of living. I know we've heard some discussion from members that possibly reinstating that for SB 88. Post-retirement pension adjustment, which is approximates inflation protection. For PERS public safety, the ARM board may provide the PRPA to employees of the defined benefit trust if the defined benefit trust fund values are equal or greater than 90% funded. And then the ARM board will have the ability to withhold the PERPA if the trust fund values fall below 90% or can adjust it down to a lower percentage rate. And then that same policy applies across the board to the PERS non-public safety and the TERS defined benefit tier.
Senator Merrick has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Kawasaki, this says the ARM board may do these things. Is there a reason we're doing may and shall? And
the ARM board, there are basically the ARM board has authority to the benefit is provided. The ARM board has discretionary authority to adjust it. So perhaps I can work on that language so that it's less of a appearing to be less discretionary. The time that the ARM board may adjust the PERPA to provide a lesser benefit would be if there's unfunded liability to the extent that's over 10%.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to be assured that should we fall below 90%, that action will be taken.
Okay.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Let's see. Sonia Kawasaki, legal counsel to the Senate majority. Benefit category, retirement medical coverage on page 3. The coverage provided it will for all three categories is consistent with PERS Tier 4, which is the defined contribution plan, and for TERS, it would be consistent with TERS Tier 3, which is the defined contribution plan. That is, major medical will be supplement to Medicare and available at age 65, and the premiums will depend on the employee's service years. The employer contribution to the health care reimbursement, it's a health care reimbursement account, it's a arrangement plan, is 3% for all employee compensation. Those will the funds of those will be directed to individual accounts for the member at retirement to use toward anything, any sort of medical coverage. I think we've heard testimony and public in public arena that the amount that HRA trust has provided for retirees has been about $100,000, whereas premiums that a person would have to pay outright until they age 65 when they may receive the coverage for major medical is about $100,000. And so that perhaps would last approximately 3 years of premiums. And then page 4, disability and death benefits. Coverage for PERS is consistent with prior PERS Tier 3, the last defined benefit plan we had. And then the bill aligns TERS with PERS for these benefits. The non-occupational benefits will provide at least minimal protection to employees and their families when they have career-ending injuries or disabilities that occur off the job. The non-occupational disability benefit is calculated as a normal retirement, as in the person's service years and salary at the time that the disability occurs. The non-occupational death benefit is provided under a formula in statute, and then the occupational disability or death provides 40% of the average base salary. And then this is more of a question, what happens to current employees hired after 2006? If this became law, for the DC members, the members and PERS and TERS who are currently receiving DC benefit, or I'm sorry, are enrolled in DC plans, could opt into the defined benefit plan, and they have approximately 4 months, or November 4th of 2024, from the date of enactment of the bill, and so that is an option for defined contribution members. And then finally, on page 5, what would happen to new employees if this became law? New employees under this bill are automatically enrolled in the defined benefit system. That's to address workforce challenges that Alaska has been experiencing in recruitment and retaining workers, and which is a primary motivation of the legislation. And we believe pensions remain the best fiscal choice to meet the needs of our retirees.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Kawasaki. Appreciate that summation, and that chart is very helpful for folks to understand the bill and is included in the bill packet. Any questions at this time for Ms. Kawasaki or the bill sponsor? Senator Giesel, would you like to make any further comments before we go to invited testimony?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thanks for hearing the bill. I look forward to the public testimony. Thank you.
You betcha. Next up, we have invited testimony. The bill sponsor has invited a selection of testifiers to talk about Senate Bill 88. First up is Ted Seidel. Ted Seidel has been referred to by the media as Sam Spade of money management, pension detective, and the equalizer for his groundbreaking work investigating money management and its potential abuses. Ted is the nation's leading expert in forensic investigations of retirement plans, focusing upon concealed and bogus investment fees and risks, fiduciary breaches, conflicts of interest, and wrongdoing. A former U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission lawyer and industry executive with over 40 years of experience, he has investigated well over $1 trillion worth in retirement plans. His further biography is available in the bill packet. Ted, thank you for joining us today. Please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can, sir.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Boardman and members of the Alaska Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, my name is Edward Seidel, and I am a financial expert in the area of pensions. I am testifying before you from Boca Raton, Florida. My short bio has been provided for you at your desks. If there are no questions, I will proceed with my testimony.
Please do. Thank you.
I'm the nation's leading expert in forensic investigations of retirement plans, a former Securities and Exchange Commission lawyer and industry executive with over 40 years of experience. I've investigated well over $1 trillion in retirement plans. In 2016, I won the first whistleblower award from the state of Indiana. In 2018, I received the largest commodity futures trading commission whistleblower award in history, $30 million. And in 2019, I won the largest whistleblower award from the Securities and Exchange Commission in the amount of $48 million. I was named as one of the 40 most influential people in the U.S. pension debate by Institutional Investor magazine for 2014 and 2015. In 2020, I and Rich Dad, Poor Dad best-selling author Robert Kiyosaki co-authored a book, Who Stole My Pension? How You Can Stop the Looting. Most recently, I authored How to Steal a Lot of Money Legally, which offers an engaging, novel approach to teaching financial literacy. Millions have read of my investigations and articles in Forbes. In addition to television interviews on CNBC and Bloomberg News, I recently appeared in two full-length documentary films, The Baby Boomer Dilemma and The Paradigm of Money. A member of the Florida Bar, I'm currently representing Screen Actors Guild members in a class action lawsuit regarding changes to the actors' health care plan during the COVID pandemic. Ed Asner, known fondly to most Americans as Lou Grant, was the lead plaintiff in this ongoing case before his passing. I'd like to begin by telling you a personal story about how I began my forensic work, which I believe explains both my commitment to protecting workers' retirement savings and my final recommendations to you today. The year the Beatles released the love song, When I'm 64, I was a teenager already thinking about aging, elder care, and retirement. A teenager thinking about getting old may seem unlikely. Let me explain. I spent my teenage years in Uganda, East Africa, with my father, until one day in July 1971, he failed to return from a journey, a safari, as we'd say in Swahili, to a remote part of the country. He and I had celebrated my 17th birthday a few days before he disappeared. My father was an American doctor of gerontology, teaching at Uganda's Makerere University, and conducting field research into the care of the aged, the elderly, in African traditional societies. Why did he choose to study how Africans took care of their elderly? Because in the mid-1960s, my father had vision and realized that America's population demographics, the massive baby boom generation, meant that in the decades to come, as 80 million hippies got older, our nation would have to care for them. For the first time in history, this young nation, a nation which celebrated youth, would have to deal with an invasion of elders. And America, he knew, was not prepared. You could say he foresaw the American elder care and retirement crisis we are struggling with today. Perhaps how African societies traditionally cared for their elders might provide answers, he thought. My father traveled extensively throughout remote parts of Uganda, which we used to call the bush, meeting with missionaries and others caring for the elderly who could not care for themselves. Through his research and travels, he developed a wide network of reliable contacts who kept him informed as to happenings in the bush. Unbeknownst to me and his colleagues at the university, the intelligence he gathered was also shared with American intelligence agencies. In 1971, when he disappeared in the garrison town of Umbarara, he was investigating rumors that Idi Amin, the new president of Uganda, had butchered hundreds of his own army soldiers stationed at the garrison without firing a single bullet. My father's disappearance alerted the world for the first time, as it was immediately reported in Newsweek magazine, that Idi Amin was brutal, a murderer who would go on to kill an estimated 500,000 of his own people. The child of a single parent, I had to return to the U.S. and live with relatives I barely knew. Since he had disappeared and was presumed dead, but his body had not been found. His estate could not be probated. His life insurance benefits would not be paid. And even Social Security survivor benefits were unavailable. In short, I was not only orphaned, but penniless. A year after his disappearance, a Ugandan commission of inquiry concluded my father had been captured by Amin, tortured and murdered because of his intelligence work. And although his body was never found, his estate was able to be probated. His life insurance benefits came through, as did Social Security survivor benefits. Through diplomatic channels, the Ugandan government offered an ex gratia payment without admitting responsibility for the murder, and paid reparations. As a result of my father's work, I was introduced to aging and elder care issues at a very young age. Further, as a result of his murder, I experienced firsthand the value of America's Social Security system and the benefits it provides not only to elders in retirement, but to their survivors, children, and the disabled in critical need. I also learned early in life to be tenacious in protecting what's most important, such as health, family, and yes, wealth. The first forensic investigation of my lifetime into the disappearance of my father was not completed until decades later in 1997, when I returned to Uganda and with the assistance of the American intelligence community and Ugandan military, I sat face to face with my father's murderer at Luzira Maximum Security Prison. Guided by his murders, I dug for but wasn't able to find my father's remains. However, I did find the answers I needed about how and when he died, as well as the satisfaction of knowing I had done all I could. Now I'd like to talk about my forensic investigations into 401k plans, which led me to write nearly 20 years ago, quote, "The great 401k experiment of the past 50 years has failed generations of American workers. And today there is broad consensus 401ks have not and cannot provide meaningful retirement security." In 2006, I was retained as a consulting expert in connection with 12 high-profile class action lawsuits filed the same day, September 11th, against many of America's largest 401k plans, including corporations such as Lockheed Martin, Kraft, Walmart, Caterpillar, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, General Dynamics, John Deere, Bechtel, ABB, and Edison. These were the very first cases to challenge the structure and management of 401ks. And the findings in these cases were surprising, even to me. I wrote about what I uncovered in my investigations in dozens of articles in Forbes and published an extensive research paper, Secrets of the 401k Industry, How Employers and Mutual Fund Advisors Prospered as Workers' Dreams of Retirement Security Evaporated. My paper documented the unsavory industry practices and regulatory failures that played a significant role in creating the defined contribution retirement crisis the nation faces today. The demise of 401ks was no accident, and indeed, was predictable, I wrote. My research found that 80% of employers believed 401ks were effective in recruiting employees to come work for them, but only 13% of employers believed that the 401k plans they offered would provide meaningful retirement security for their workers. In other words, employers understood that offering plans that purported to provide for workers' retirement security was helpful in building their businesses. However, employers privately acknowledged that these plans were not sufficient to provide for retirement. On the other hand, employers believe that guaranteed retirement income, such as traditional pension plans, would be far more costly to provide. So I wrote, do employers tell their workers there really is no retirement security provided if they stay in their jobs and thereby risk losing these employees to competitors? Or do employers maintain the charade that they offer retirement security? Has any employer ever acknowledged to workers that it is virtually inconceivable that the defined contribution plan he offers will provide sufficient retirement income? I ask you today, have you ever heard an employer admit that there is no way employers will ever be able to retire on their 401k savings? I have never seen such a disclosure. 2 weeks ago, in an article in Forbes entitled "Alaska State Workers Hoodwinked into Believing 401k Style Retirement Plan Was as Good as a Pension," I wrote about my experience as an expert retained to speak on the behalf of City of Atlanta Police about a proposal by the city to force workers into a 401k type plan. I began my comments to the Atlanta City Council saying, quote, "We are on the precipice of the greatest retirement crisis in the history of the world. In the decades to come, we will witness tens of millions of elderly Americans slipping into poverty. Too frail to work, too poor to retire will become the new normal for elderly Americans. If you don't believe me," I said, "look at who's bagging your groceries. It used to be high school kids. Now it's men and women in their 70s or even 80s. I explained to the city council that 401k defined contribution plans are largely to blame for this foreseeable tragedy, and forcing public employees into 401ks would only ensure greater misery. I said, quote, 401ks cannot and will not provide meaningful retirement security for the overwhelming number of America's workers, and certainly not the public employees of the city of Atlanta." Notice that I did not refer to 401ks as retirement plans in my comments. That was intentional. 401ks were not meant to be retirement. Let me say that again. 401ks were never intended to provide retirement security. They were initially envisioned as a way for management level people to put aside extra retirement money, cash in addition to their pensions, much like 457 deferred compensation plans for government employees that rely primarily upon pensions for their retirement security. In the 1980s, the 401k was embraced by big corporations as a replacement for costly pension funds. Suddenly, large companies were able to transfer the burden of funding employees' retirement to the employees themselves. Virtually all the major private employers jumped on the bandwagon. The surreal vision of turning rank and file workers into astute portfolio managers, each responsible for successfully directing his own investments, took hold. Unfortunately, things didn't work out quite as well for the workers, not as well as it did for the employers and the financial services companies. Since the initial class action lawsuits I was involved with in 2006, virtually all the largest employers in the world have been sued regarding their 401ks. Over a decade ago, way back in 2010, 84% of Americans surveyed said it was time for new, improved workplace retirement plans. 84%. That's a staggering dissatisfaction rate. As I've said in my Forbes articles, 401ks are the biggest investment fraud ever perpetrated upon America's workers. I believe it ought to be a crime to call these retirement plans. Call them supplemental savings plans or rainy day accounts, but don't call them retirement plans and mislead workers to believe that 401ks will provide for their retirement security. They won't. Today, with a median 401k balance for 65-year-olds of $62,000, the decades many elders will spend in so-called retirement will be grim. I told the Atlanta City Council, quote, "So if you vote to force your city's public employees into a 401k type system, at least be honest about it and admit from the get-go that this is no retirement plan." In closing, it was no secret in 2006, and it is abundantly clear today that 401k type plans do not provide anything near the level of retirement security as pensions. I feel nothing but compassion for Alaskan state workers who were forced to unwittingly sacrifice their retirement security 17 years ago. The retirement crisis Alaskan state workers are facing today was foreseeable and indeed was foreseen. My recommendation to you is that a well-managed pension should be established immediately for state workers going forward. But that's not enough. Workers who were forced into the 401k type scheme 17 years ago are deserving of compensation that will ensure comparable levels of retirement security. They should not be left behind. As I learned in Africa over 50 years ago, you must protect the health and wealth, the lives of those who are most important to you. I urge you to act to protect Alaska state workers. Thank you for this opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Seidel, for your testimony. And if you could provide a copy of your written remarks to us here the Labor and Commerce Committee, we will get that entered into the record and make sure it's well documented. Are there any Are there any questions for Mr. Seidel? Senator Bishop.
Thank you. Thanks for taking the time today. And I think you have hit the nail on the head what a lot of us have been saying for 17 years. And as somebody that's fortunate to have a DB plan, I've been making your arguments for a long time, but not as eloquently as you.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Seidel, I have a question for you in regards to your experience with different types of savings accounts and retirement plans. Would it be cheaper, do you think, for an entity like the state of Alaska to invest in a defined benefit plan than a defined contribution plan as it relates to the benefit that the state would get for its invested dollar?
Well, the key to running a defined benefit plan is to have full transparency, low costs, and largely looking at index funds, passively managed funds. This is the recommendation of Warren Buffett. It has been my recommendation for decades now. So a well-run pension plan can be cheaper than a poorly managed 401k plan. Can provide more meaningful benefits. Unfortunately, most defined benefit plans are not run as efficiently as they should. They are not as transparent, they have higher costs, and they have greater risk than is disclosed. But I think that a well-run pension plan can provide benefits at a comparable cost.
Thank you very much. Senator Gray Jackson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you so much for your presentation. It was quite compelling. So in Alaska, as everybody knows, we have a really high cost of living. So what's your thoughts on including a cost of living phase, I guess I'd call it that, within our, a defined benefit plan.
It's my belief that a cost of living adjustment is fair because the cost of living does rise over time. And so I would suggest that you have a cost of living adjustment. Otherwise, over the course of an employee's, say, 30 years of retirement, their retirement benefit can be cut easily in half with inflation over time.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Seidel, for your testimony today. Seeing no other questions, we will move on to our next testifier in the queue. We'll take a brief of these. We're back on the record, 2:35 here in Belts Room 105. Next up for invited testimony, we have Bill Popp from the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation joining us via Teams. He'll speak on workforce impacts. Mr. Popp, please put yourself on the record. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Bill Popp. I am President and CEO of the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation. It is a pleasure to be here today. I would open with the immediate statement that I'm not here to speak necessarily in support or opposition to the bill, as my organization has not taken a position on this particular piece of legislation at this time. However, I was asked to come and provide context for the current labor force situation in Anchorage and by association, the state of Alaska, to perhaps offer a little bit of context in the competitive nature nationally that we are dealing with and will be dealing with for decades to come with the apogee that we have reached in total labor force in the United States that we are about to go over the edge on. Anchorage Economic Development Corporation has since 2010 been trying to move the ball in making Anchorage a more competitive city for attracting and retaining labor force, whether we've attracted it here or keeping our younger population here in greater numbers, to assure our success in the future. Unfortunately, we have not been successful in those efforts, and in the last decade, we have seen a decline of our population, but more so a decline in our overall labor force. The state of Alaska, in general, has lost in the last decade over 30,000 working-age adults. Anchorage has shared half of that burden, losing nearly 15,000 working-age adults compared to how many we had just 10 years ago. This has been a result of net out-migration. Alaska has for decades had a population that has churned with tens of thousands of Alaskans moving out of state, being offset by, in many cases, by tens of thousands of new Alaskans moving to our state from the lower 48 and to a much lesser degree elsewhere in the world. This has kept us in relative balance since the 70s, with some years of net working age adult loss, but overall, we've pretty much had a fairly balanced labor market for those decades. But in this last decade, we have seen a point of net out-migration now where we still have the same number of people moving out of state, but we are no longer attracting as many people to our state from the lower 48, thereby showing a lack of regeneration of our labor force. All age categories in the last decade have shown either dead flat or mostly net population loss in the working age categories. This is a significant issue that we're going to be dealing with for decades to come. As the previous speaker has referenced, we do have a generational shift. The baby boom generation is now going into retirement. At this point, approximately 41 million baby boomers nationwide are still in the working age category of under 64 years of age. But by 2030, all baby boomers will be 65 or older. Our state has a propensity of older working adults. We have not seen the younger generations moving to Alaska. in as great a numbers as we have needed, and we have seen an acceleration of older adults moving out of our state. And then in conjunction with that, we are seeing accelerated rates of retirement in the baby boom generation. It is a generation that is headed for the door fairly quickly when it comes to retirement, with the largest number of baby boomers retiring in the 62 to 63 age category. Overall, our population in Anchorage has gone from 19% being of age of 55 or older in 2010 to 25% in the most recent census projection data from the State of Alaska Department of Labor Research Division. This is a significant shift and is representative of a longer-term shift that is going to be taking place in the coming decades, with the baby boom generation at 78 million stepping off the stage. The Gen X, Generation X, only has 68 million coming up behind us nationwide. Behind that is a slight increase with the millennial generation at 72 million. But when we look at Gen Z, which is now a defined generation with an unnamed generation coming up behind it at less than 5 years of age, but Gen Z is only 62 million. This has created in our world of the professional world of economic development a national competition that we refer to as the talent wars that have been going on for over a decade now nationally, with communities gearing up for this change, this demographic shift, and that is going to create labor force shortages. Communities that have been investing in quality of place, different amenities that are needed, as well as competitive policies that are designed to attract and retain workforce. We are seeing the fact that Alaska fundamentally has kind of been asleep at the wheel. We've been caught up in old habit, the idea that it's Alaska and people move here no matter what. It's just a short-term cycle, nothing to worry about. Well, that cycle is now over a decade in length. And I would offer to the committee that this is a fundamental shift in how the future looks for Alaska. We will have plenty of opportunity. Our economy shows great opportunity right now. Last year in Anchorage and the Mat-Su, we had over 69,000 job postings, individual distinct job postings that we were able to identify through our research tools. So far this year, just through the month of March, we have nearly 27,000 job postings that are unique and distinct to this area. Job demand continues to remain strong. In the month of December, Anchorage recorded an all-time record low unemployment rate of 2.7%. And mind you, this is a center of gravity for the context of today's hearing for literally thousands of state, federal, and local government workers who will make up a significant part of our economy. If you throw in the university and the school districts and the school district's employees, that generates about one out of five jobs in Anchorage, second only to Anchorage International Airport, which generates one out of seven jobs in our city. This is a significant shift. This is a significant issue for us. We could be replacing literally thousands and thousands of jobs that are currently going vacant this year and converting those into actual employment, but we don't have the bodies. And this extends to municipal, state, and federal government. There is a national competition that is taking place in those categories also. And we see it in the shortfalls in the different departments of state government that is leading to bottlenecks for companies to get projects permitted, to get key certifications taken care of, to deal with any number of issues that state government is charged with dealing with that are vital to business investments being done in a timely manner in our state and are currently constraining business in terms of time delays and challenges in getting projects and investments off the ground and investments deployed. These are reasons why we do support the idea of a solid exploration of how state government is going to fill those positions, those literally thousands of open positions in state government that are vital to the future of our state in terms of getting economic activity going in a timely manner and taking advantage of investment that if it can't deploy here in a timely manner, is going to go somewhere else and look for opportunities to deploy there. When we look at what we're going to be facing in the future, the State of Alaska Department of Labor latest Trends magazine provides a complete dissertation on the outlook over the next 30 years when it comes to working age adults. and the picture is not pretty. The mid-case scenario shows an average annual loss of 0.2% of working-age adults over that 30-year period. That's the mid-case. The worst case is a loss of 150,000 working-age adults over that 30-year period, which I truly, truly hope and believe and will do everything I can to fight that ever taking place. And the most optimistic, which is based on a very short period of significant labor force growth in the previous 30 years, that did show a 0.5% growth in labor force in the state. But it's our view at Anchorage Economic Development Corporation that companies in the future are going to be looking more and more as their top priority in deploying an investment. Where is the labor force stable and growing and that meets our expectations for what we want to deploy our capital for to create new business and investments? And if there is not a stable labor force, if there is a declining labor force, we will begin to see an erosion of the economic opportunities that lay before us in the coming decades. And I think that one of the most important sectors, besides the broader sectors of professional development, healthcare, engineering, and all the other industry sectors that are represented in the private sector, is going to be the critical need to have great schools that have staff that are fully staffed out, that are providing excellent education opportunities, both at the K-12 and the university level, as well as government services that are providing key services that young workers and family age workers and mid-career workers, as well as senior workers, are all expecting in the community that they want to live in and invest their time and efforts in to generate their futures. And right now, we are not making that great. The numbers tell us that. We lost over 4,000 people just last year from in the working age category just here in Anchorage. This is not a trend that we can continue to just sit idly by and cross our fingers and hope for. We need to start taking proactive steps. Anchorage Economic Development Corporation, in partnership with other business organizations in Anchorage, are focused on our Choose Anchorage plan, which is focused on business vitality, but primarily on talent. How to develop more talent, higher skilled workers within the local workforce that we have, as well as attracting critical workers that we need from across the nation that we're never going to fill from within our own population. We do this in the face of the higher costs that were mentioned earlier in the previous testimony during the Q&A, which Anchorage and the state of Alaska on average is about 26% above national average. That takes down the buying power of our paychecks and our payroll and benefits packages significantly when it comes to a competitive point of view, competing against any number of other cities across the United States where somebody can step out the door and point to mountains around them and say, see, that's the only reason you need to live here. That model doesn't work anymore. We have to offer a better deal for workers to get them to move here and to stay here. One last point is the fact that our youth in Anchorage, which is one of the only cities that's profiled in the state of Alaska and using new census analysis by the U.S. Census Bureau, has demonstrated that we lose 34% of our 16 to 26-year-olds from the state of Alaska in the city of Anchorage. They leave and they never come back. And that is a huge drain of opportunity. And so whatever we can do to offer better enticements, better ways to attract and retain workers in our cities and in our communities and in our state is going to be critical for the economic future and success of the state of Alaska. Mr. Chairman, I would leave off with one last point. I think that there is another book that I think would be important for committee members and anybody else listening to take a look at. It's called When the Boomers Bail, and it was written in 2011. And it lays out this story in no uncertain terms as to what's going to happen to cities that do not, and states that do not adapt to the changing demographics nationally that are going to lead us to a nationwide labor force talent war over that's going to continue on for decades to come. I would encourage everyone to read that book. It's a short read, and it's easy to pick up. It's available in Kindle if you just want to download it. But I have to encourage everyone to take a look at it. I don't agree with 100% of everything that's in the book, but it is prophetic in most of its analysis of what we are going to be facing as cities and communities in Alaska and as a state. Mr. Chair, with that, I would go ahead and end my testimony and be happy to answer any questions of the members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Pop. Do any committee members have questions? Thank you again. Because of the time, we are going to go to invited testimony in the room, and then we will ask folks to come back who are on Teams for our next opportunity, which will be on Friday. Up next, we have Lisa Parity with the Alaska Council of School Administrators. Ms. Parity, please come up to the table as you are so preparedly doing. Put your name and affiliation on the record, and please begin your testimony when ready.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dr. Lisa Skiles Parity. I am the Executive Director of the Alaska Council of School Administrators. And as most of you know, ACSA is a 50-year-old nonprofit organization that was created to serve as an umbrella to some of Alaska's premier educational organizations, including the Superintendents Association, elementary school principals, secondary school principals, school business officials, and the host of other administrators serving our students across Alaska. And I want to thank you for inviting me to speak today in support of SB 88, and specifically how Alaska's recruitment and retention crisis is impacting all of Alaska's school districts. We've heard some about that today. As the Senate Majority Leader stated in her bill sponsor statement, this bill addresses Alaska's workforce challenges with recruitment and retention head-on through establishing a new defined benefit retirement plan for teachers and other public employees. My comments are really in support of this piece, and momentarily I'm going to show you some very current research from All Educators showing that this is the highest priority for many of them in Alaska. ACSA supports all school districts and represents education leaders across our state. We are united in our priorities of educators for both urban and rural school districts and communities. We understand that there is no room for division in Alaska. There's no room for division between large and small, urban, rural, and remote. All districts are experiencing shortages at every level. And as you heard Mr. Pop say, in most communities, school districts are the largest employer or are in the top three of largest employers. So this is having a great impact on communities just from the business standpoint as well. Each year, our members work together on the joint position statements. Some of you are probably tired of getting them because I offer them often. And in essence, they envelop the highest priorities for Alaska education policy positions. Student achievement is our number one priority always, but recruitment and retention of educators are essential aspects of public education. And you have the joint position statements tabbed with the positions that are relevant to the testimony today in front of you in these position statements. Many of the areas in education are suffering from staffing shortages that are impacting daily lives of our students. And we've seen this across Alaskan headlines, some of which were shared by Senator Geisel. Some of you seen in your own communities are busing issues, et cetera. We're all, I think, tired of thinking about the impacts, but I really want to stress to you today some of the research that shares how deep those impacts go for Alaska. And in this slide, in a study by the Regional Education Laboratory Northwest, or REL Northwest for short, they found that educator turnover impacts Alaska's rural and remote schools the most. I think there's no surprise with that. But it is amazing to see that teacher and principal turnover over 35%
in our most rural and remote school districts, 38% turnover with principals. And I'll note that this is pre-pandemic, so these numbers are higher at this point. That's staggering for those schools. In a study, continuing with this study, and Mr. Pop just talked about this, but the out-migration is what we're seeing as well. Educator turnover is leading to instability in our classrooms and our schools. It's directly impacting student achievement, and there is data to support that. The same study I shared from REL shows that in 2018, 13% of our teacher turnover were teachers who left the state or education altogether. 17% of principals and 19% of superintendents were leavers as well. And again, those numbers have increased because of the pandemic. ICER did some great work on the costs of this turnover. You may be familiar with it, but it's worth revisiting. They found in 2017 that the cost to replace a teacher is in excess of $20,000. And I would submit to you that those costs have gone up significantly as well. In a similar study done in 2019 by RAND, they shared that the cost to replace a principal is $75,000. So if you think about the slide I just showed you with 38% turnover of principals in our most rural and remote areas, and you look at these costs, it's a significant impact to our school district budgets. And just to take another look at that, the Wallace Foundation shared in a school leader study that when strong principals are at the helm of a school, they positively influence school culture and the instructional quality of the whole system of teachers. However, when a principal turns over, students achieve less in both math and reading during the first year after a leader turnover, and schools that experience principal churn year after year, which we see in Alaska, have serious cumulative negative effects on our students. This is a condition that is exacerbated for schools serving underprivileged or poverty students. So you can see that this is impacting Alaska significantly. This is a breakdown of costs from ICER study on teacher turnover. And remember, the study was from 2017. So these costs were pre the 40-year high inflation rates that we're experiencing right now. This is a hard slide to see. Here's a photo composite of the 54 superintendents from the 2018-19 year. The photos of superintendents who are no longer working in the state are marked out, and you can add two more to this slide from this year. So when you consider the superintendent turnover, the principal turnover, the teacher turnover, it all equates to just instability. And so the high turnover, I want to link that back to the importance of recruitment and retention in particular. But want to stress to you that this instability in our schools can be correlated to low achievement in the classroom. A study by ICER again shows that the school districts with the five lowest rates of teacher turnover had better reading scores than the schools with the highest rates of teacher turnover. And I think, you know, it's important for us, particularly as we're putting so much focus on reading and the importance of reading, to recognize that these are linked. They go together hand in hand. If we can stabilize school districts, our students' achievement will improve. So in 2023, our joint position statements that our members put together prioritize retirement system for educators. And according to the Economic Policy Institute, the average teacher earns 21% less than professionals with a college degree. This gap in salary can be offset some by providing robust retirement system for Alaska educators. Retaining highly qualified educators and leaders is imperative to increase student achievement and eliminate academic disparity for all of our Alaska students. Nationally competitive compensation and benefits package combined with a robust retirement system is imperative to attract and retain effective educators. And let's look at some recent data from the governor's task force on teacher recruitment and retention. This interviewed over 4,000 educators in the 21-22 year. And you can see for administrators who are trying to hire staff, it is the retirement and benefits are the number one priority for them. So this bill is so important to the stability for school districts. This slide shows the response from all of the people surveyed, and it shows that in the same survey of the governor's teacher retention recruitment committee, three of the top 10 solutions to educator retention are related to retirement benefits. And I don't need to read number 3, 7, and 8, but it's compelling given that over 4,000 educators responded to this in Alaska last year and said this will make an impact on our stability in our school district and ultimately on our student achievement of students. Other states, this is a hard slide to look at, but this is from a recent job fair that a superintendent sent me. Other states and educators know that Alaska doesn't offer a competitive retirement system. So I had a superintendent trying to recruit, and right next door, this flyer was being handed out to potential candidates to come work in the district. They texted it to me, and it was kind of hard to see, you know, warning prospective teachers not to teach in Alaska, and the reason given because of not having an appropriate retirement system. This friends don't let friends teach in Alaska is not a slogan that we want for our state. And we see this bill as an opportunity to start to shift that terrain. So by offering a defined benefit option to our Alaska educators, it will help close the gap in retention in our schools, and it will attract new teachers to the state, really hitting at the heart of our huge issues around retention and recruitment. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions. I thank you for the opportunity to testify, and thank you so much to all of you for making this a priority.
Thank you. Are there questions from members of the committee? Senator Bishop.
Dr. Parody, I'd like to go back to that last slide. There's two bullets. Couldn't you put another bullet there off the data you had on the three or four previous slides that will also students will be reading at 85% of grade level?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, I am not sure I'd put a percent on it, but I do believe that we will see increased student achievement if these things happen.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to thank Dr. Parody for getting through 15 slides in 12 minutes. Mm-hmm. Very impressive.
To the chair, Senator Dunbar, thank you. I was told, and I listened.
Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Ms. Parody, for being with us. Are there any changes or suggestions that you have for Senate Bill 88?
Through the chair, Senator Merrick, that is a fantastic question. And so the way that we're addressing it is through going through the bill, you know, kind of line by line with our members focus on this. We have an overall position in support of moving this direction. And so we support it, but we will be bringing any prospective or proposed changes forward. And you know, I would just add that you've made this in the Senate majority one of your highest priorities. We're in alignment, and so this is the right start. It's the right way to go, and the
changes, if any, that come forward, I think will be ones that are reasonable and will come from that frontline perspective of how to retain and attract our teachers. And it's substitute teachers, it's paraprofessionals, it's principals, it's superintendents, it's bus drivers, it's everyone in school districts, and it's all across the state. It doesn't matter if it's urban or rural. So we are with you. We are going to bring any proposed changes forward. But at this point, there seems to be a lot of support for this bill within our membership.
Great, thank you.
Thank you.
Briefities. We're back on the record. Next up, under invited testimony, Mr. Jordan Adams, Public Employees Local 71. Mr. Adams, please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony. Welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce.
Thank you for making the time. For the record, my name is Jordan Adams. I'm the business manager of Public Employees Local 71 Union. Local 71 is a statewide union composed of blue-collar essential workers. Just for the record, again, it's equipment operators, light and heavy-duty mechanics, carpenters, electricians, building maintenance, and custodians. As last time, we plow 20,000 road miles, maintain 3 international airports, and all the critical infrastructure. Our service ensures safety to the traveling public and commerce. With the rising cost of living, job vacancies, this retirement system must be addressed. The state can't keep or attract qualified workers when the wages and benefits are not competitive. When we don't have workers, we have gaps. Gaps in direct services for Alaskans. SB 88 is a step in the right direction. This is just one piece of the puzzle, though. Wages and benefits go hand in hand. Public sector work has never paid more than private, but the benefits used to be comparable. With a less desirable wage and benefit package, the state has rendered itself uncompetitive and now faces the reality of not being able to attract qualified workers. The skills required for many of our positions we represent are advanced journey. That means many hours of training, certificates, and licenses. These are all essential direct services positions that keep Alaska moving forward. Alaska is the only state that does not offer secure defined benefits for public employees. The current retirement offered is not the incentive we saw under the previous ones. You have an opportunity to right this ship. SB 88 can start that process. We've lived with Tier 4 retirement for over 16 years now. But many applicants find it underwhelming that the retirement benefits are no longer what they thought they were going to be. It weighs heavily on someone's decision to work for the state. We all know that staffing shortages are hurting every department. Some areas are now understaffed by 30% or more. Snow events and emergencies are now more difficult than ever to overcome, not simply because of the weather, but because the understaffed crews do not have the capacity or the workforce they need, resulting in overwork, unstable work schedules to keep up. While it's all hands on deck, the limited number of employees are being burned out. This should not be a permanent solution to being understaffed. The high vacancy rates are not sustainable. We need the tools to prepare our overworked and underappreciated workforce, and we're asking for that change. State jobs have merely become a training ground for employees, and once the skills are acquired, those employees, along with their mobile 401ks, leave for better positions outside of state services. The state is failing itself for not having wages and benefits to retain qualified workers and letting monies invested in those people lock out the door. In closing, the state of Alaska has lost its ability to be a serious contender in an increasingly competitive marketplace that has resulted in its inability to bring on a qualified workforce. And with incoming infrastructure funds, which will lead to an increase in demand for qualified blue-collar workers, if we don't fix these issues soon, we may not be able to. Without a stable workforce, safety can't respond. Our airports closed during storms. People can't commute to their jobs, and emergency services are impacted. I thank you for your time today, and I ask you to talk to your colleagues, and let's find a retirement solution for all public employees. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Adams. Are there questions for Mr. Adams from members of the committee? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
Our next meeting of Senate Labor and Commerce will be Friday, when we will take up Senate Bill 70, Owner and Contractor Controlled Insurance, as well as, once again, Senate Bill 88, Retirement Systems and Defined Benefit Option. As there is no further business to come before the committee, this meeting is adjourned at 3:08 p.m.